This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. John's a regular guest on the show, appears periodically to talk about the latest in acquisition reform, what's going on the Hill, all that good stuff. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Good to be back.
Well, I'm looking forward to our discussion, and it's February, but it's a Happy New Year, I guess. So one of the things I'd like to do is take some time to talk about what transpired last year, to sort of wrap up some issues, and whether it's the Defense Authorization Act, what was in that, the Budget Reform Act, those type of things. So I'm just going to open it up to you, and you can start. What was of interest to our government contractor audience out there?
We had a lot of very interesting things that happened very late in the year. Two bills, very significant bills. The first was the Budget Reform Act of 2013. Which modified and then set the budget caps, and basically which will govern the top lines for both fiscal year 14 and fiscal year 15, which should allow us to have a much more of a, if there is such a thing, a normal appropriations process this coming year, because we'll at least have agreement on those larger overall numbers. And then the Defense Authorization Bill was wrapped up as well about the same time. Both bills were signed within minutes of each other on December the 26th. The authorization bill was signed first. The Budget Reform Act was signed second. That is significant because there was a conflict between two of the provisions in the bill that were in the acquisition reform area. I'll talk about in just a minute. The authorization bill this year wasn't quite as heavy with acquisition reform or acquisition policy provisions as we've seen in the past couple of years. I'll just mention a couple of them that I think will be of interest to the audience. One is a provision in Title 16, dealing with reporting on small business participation in government contracting. There is now a government-wide provision in Section 1614, which mandates that contractors, after the methodology is worked out, will be able to count toward their subcontracting goals all of the dollars that in their subcontracting that go to small business, including those below the first tier, which is an issue that's been discussed for several years, and Congress finally decided to go ahead and set that process up. If you look at the language, there's an extended implementation period for that, so it probably is something that if everything goes on track, we will not see a major change until 2016 or even 2017. But that should have an interesting impact on how the small business subcontracting participation goals look in the agencies and the company strategies that they have for involving small businesses at all tiers. And so we'll see how that works.
A question for you, though, on that is that, when you describe that and think about it, one of the things that clearly comes to mind, you mentioned implementation. Does that turn into, our expectations are that your goals will be set higher, that, reflecting the fact that you're counting more potential opportunities to provide business to small business subcontractors? Just what's your sense on that?
It's hard to say. I think what really will be the test will be what the methodology looks like, because obviously one of the issues is double counting. There's been a discussion of this whole effort or idea for a while, and that was always the thing that people could never quite figure out, was how to do the methodology to prevent that. But assuming that you can get the methodology worked out, I think folks are going to want to look at the numbers and see what they really show. In my opinion, whatever you decide to do, at least you'll have much better data to work with going forward, and a much clearer picture of how those dollars flow at all the various tiers. So I just think we'll be in a much better informed environment as far as, deciding how effective small business participation programs are in the federal space.
And so subcontractors, both small and large, got that first tier, are now going to have to turn around and report up the chain.
Right, exactly.
Okay, and other issues there?
I think the other one that's probably was also a fairly significant impact was the cap on contractor compensation reimbursement. This issue, and this is on cost-type contracts primarily, this issue has been kicking around now for quite some time. Folks might remember back in 1997, we set a formula in place which placed a cap. At that time, it only applied to the top five senior executives in the corporation. A few years ago, that cap was expanded to the entire contractor workforce, but the cap has grown pretty significantly based on the formula, and especially since the 2004 timeframe. I think the last number that OMB came out with under the formula for costs incurred in 2012 was about $950,000, and I think folks were concerned that the cap was essentially set too high. So the question is, we had a number of different ideas for lowering the cap, and in fact, what we have now is we have a conflict between Section 811 and the authorization bill, which set the baseline for costs in fiscal year 14 at $625,000, and then there was a provision which was nearly identical in Section 702 in the Budget Reform Act, and that set the cap at $487,000. So we had a conflict, and in a case like that, whichever bill gets signed last by the president is the one that is the controlling level. And so in this case, the Budget Reform Act lower number was signed last. So that is now
funny how that works, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other interesting thing is that this new cap only applies to costs on contracts that are entered into on or after June 24th, 2014. So you're in a situation now where we're going to have two caps. We have the one current cap, which has been in place now for quite some time, with its own formula, and it's going to be in place for the costs incurred under existing contracts. And then as new contracts are signed in the middle of the year, we're going to have this other cap apply.
How does that, I mean, I'm just curious, just thinking about it, you know, when you have a multiple award IDIQ contract, let's say like Alliant that has cost reimbursement capability in it that you can get at the task order, is the implementation based on the contract or, you know, which is entered into several years ago, so it would be, you know, the current cap versus, you know, a task order award for a competition? Are they, you know, do you have any sense of what's going to go on there or if they thought about that?
I don't know if anybody's thought about it. I don't expect that the implementation rules are going to be worked out by June 24th. We had a similar situation.
Yeah, funny how that works too, right?
Yeah. Well, we had a similar situation in the mid-90s when you had a series of different caps that were put in place on annual appropriations bills. And I just looked at a memo that came out from DCAA about that time, and they basically had come to the conclusion that using some sort of a combined rate was really not you know, allowable approach.
Sure.
And so they wanted to have something that differentiated in order to actually capture what was unallowable and allowable. A further issue here is that the old cap for DOD contracts applies to all contractor employees' compensation, but for civilian agencies, it still only applies to the top five executives. The new cap applies in both civilian agencies and in federal agencies to the compensation for all contractor employees. So that's a further complication.
Yeah, it's getting complicated there.
Right, Jonathan. Right.
Yeah, and even I'm just thinking about it. If you tried to apply it on a task order basis under an existing contract vehicle, a company could have two tasks going on parallel under one contract
right.
with different compensation, you know, reimbursement schemes, right?
I mean, right, and if you're basically rolling up your compensation in a G&A kind of
sure.
thing for all your contracts,
yeah.
How are you going to handle that? So I think there's going to be some interesting methodologies that are going to have to be developed for capturing the nuances and the relationships between these two cap regimes.
Yeah, and from that perspective, do you see this as, how long do you think it will take them to figure it out?
Or? I don't have any idea. I haven't talked to anybody, for example, over at the Defense Contract Audit Agency, nor anybody over at Defense Contract Management Agency. But I think that if you look back now in the reformulations when they do this on an annual basis, keep in mind they've only gone as far as calendar year 12 in mm-hmm. terms of the current cap. So there's always a lag factor in terms of the refiguring this, and I think that's just something we're going to have to be dealing with in this as well, in addition to this methodology for how to apportion it and how to calculate it for compensation costs across different contracts.
Right, and in terms of the competing caps, is there a lot of politics involved in that at the time? Is it really about how, you know, really you make, you know, the value judgment of paying a, you know, a government contractor employee or reimbursing the company for those costs versus, you know, a federal employee, a lot of that kind of language around it.
I think there was a fair amount of that consideration, especially with respect to the Budget Reform Act. And if you look at the CBO scoring document that accompanied that act, they were essentially looking for savings from a number of different provisions, including the now somewhat infamous cut to the COLA for military retirees. The one thing that was not scored at all was this particular, you know, change in the cap, because CBO doesn't really have a methodology
to
assign scoring for something like that. So it leaves you with the conclusion that it was a political decision, not something that was needed in order to get to the numbers under the bill.
Okay, and Jonathan, right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we'll continue talking about, you know, we're wrapping up last year and start looking ahead to this year and what's going on in the procurement world right now in terms of the Hill and potential reform or not. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Shouldn't a workstation live up to its billing? If yours are no longer working, there's Initiate from the Han Company. Initiate workstations are easy to order, install, and reconfigure. Components fit precisely and provide endless ways for space planners to arrange people. Initiate is also highly sustainable, helping reduce your environmental footprint. Initiate workstations, inspired by the practical needs of the workplace. Online at Han.com. That's HON.com.
Well, welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And, you know, John, when we took the break, we had finished that, I think, compensation. We covered that. You covered that. You nailed that. You got all the information out there. I just wanted to wrap up the year, I guess, so to speak, by giving you a chance to just talk about if there's anything else or the lack of any further kind of procurement-related, you know, legislation that really stands out to you, sort of, you know, symbolizes where Congress has been, and then we can start talking about where Congress may be going.
Well, I think the one thing, just to sort of conclude on the process, was obviously we got the Consolidated Appropriations Bill passed in January, which reflects the revised caps for both civilian agencies and the defense side. That's important for a number of reasons. Number one, it sort of settles a lot of issues and actually resulted in there being an actual annual appropriations bill now for each of the federal agencies, which is something we haven't had for 4 or 5 years. And it also, I think, set the stage for sort of clearing that issue off the table, and now folks can focus on the FY15 process. There was not a lot because of some of the issues that were addressed, as I mentioned, in the authorization bill. There wasn't really anything, I think, of great significance that was added to any of the general provisions in the appropriations bill dealing with acquisition policy. So I think that you know, pretty much didn't really break any new ground. But I think now that we have a situation where sequestration, it looks like, will no longer be a factor, and some of the other implications from the budget side on the process, I think now we can sort of move forward. And I think we're probably looking at some new horizons, in my opinion, on the acquisition policy or acquisition reform front starting this year.
Yeah, well, one of the things, too, the fact that, you know, you've got these, you know, we don't have sequestration to deal with right now, and there's some more certainty. I think that, I mean, that's a wonderful thing from an agency's perspective. At least they can plan and there's expectations. And for companies as well, there's a little bit more certainty, I think, in the market. Is that fair to say?
Right. I think that's fair. Yeah. I think, and I also think, don't discount the value to the agencies, especially some of the civilian agencies, who for years have been operating on a continuing resolution, who now have a formal FY14 appropriations with the flexibility that affords them in terms of how they do their budgets. So that's another very positive thing with this whole process.
Right. And you don't know, I mean, over the last couple of years, the number of times I've had lawyers come on the show to talk about, like, you know, you see, you know, what happens if the money's cut off? How do I deal as a contractor with my customer, the government? You know, all those rules about fiscal law issues.
Right.
You know, all that kind of stuff repeatedly over and over again, like Groundhog Day. So it is kind of nice that conversation is off the table for a little while.
And we did it in January instead of late March or April, which I think is another very positive
very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
you know, last year there was, and this, I think we're going to transition a little bit to, you know, what may go on this year or in the next couple of years, you know, healthcare.gov and what happened there. And there's lots of focus and oversight or energy around, like, how did this happen? What role did the procurement system play in it? You know, how were requirements development? You name it. I heard conversations about it. And is that sort of, from your perspective, you know, what has been the fallout of that on the Hill or just generally in the community, people talking about the procurement system?
I think people are still trying to assess what happened with the Affordable Care Act implementation and trying to get the details and really understand the extent to which either the current culture rules on the acquisition side with respect to information technology acquisition drove some of the decision-making that got the outcome that we got, whether it was a statutory issue, whether it was a cultural issue. I would note that one of the things that didn't happen last year in the authorization bill was passage of some form of the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, which was a title that had been, it was mainly oriented toward the civilian agencies' acquisition of IT, and it was added to the Defense Authorization Bill on the House side, and it didn't, in fact, get included in any form in the final bill. I think that we had a lot of discussion around the Affordable Care Act implementation before the fall, I think there may have been a reconsideration of that decision, but I don't know. But that now is back as a live issue. I think there are a number of other proposals that people on the Hill are looking at with respect to information technology acquisition that they feel may address some of the issues that were or will be uncovered in the Affordable Care Act. So I think that is really a live issue. But I think more importantly, it's really sort of feeding into this larger process that I see emerging where people are really starting to question the cost of the current acquisition process. And in light of the budget, which is now, you know, been set, as at least for the next couple of years, whether we can afford the cost of the acquisition process itself as it's currently structured. And so we are now, I see emerging a new interest in a more fundamental approach to acquisition reform than maybe we've seen in the last couple of years, and sort of hearkening back to some of the principles that were under discussion in the 1990s when we saw enactment of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the National Performance Review and things like that. So I think we are sort of in a potential sea change in the way that the process and the costs associated with it are being viewed. And I think the Affordable Care Act, you know, rollout and the issues with that are feeding that process to a considerable degree.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's the transactional cost or the cost. I mean, you can measure the cost in many different ways. It's, you know, how hard is it to do business with the federal government? How much cost is associated with that for a commercial firm? Because companies have to make a profit too, right? And there are margins. And, you know, if the margins become more difficult, you know, if a commercial company, the federal government represents 1 or 2% of their overall sales, or even less typically, yeah, they can make a business decision not to deal with the federal government, I think, in the long run. So I think that sounds like it's maybe a positive development moving forward. But another thing, and that's my sort of little editorial there, John. But the other thing, you know, when you talk about costs, there's also costs about with regard to outcomes. And, you know, to the extent we look at the system, do you have any thoughts on, you know, where people would look to identify how to improve outcomes, whether it's requirements development or whatever? What are people thinking out there, or what are you hearing?
I don't think people have really had much of a success getting their arms around those kinds of issues. I think they are thinking about them. I think each of the stakeholders that I've been talking to over the past month or so, whether it's people on the Hill or in the committees, or even people in the executive branch, are really looking at you know, different ways to understand how you proceed for a process, how do you proceed for evaluating different policy alternatives. But I think one of the things that I think we're in a position to do now, maybe that we weren't in a position to do in the 1990s, is actually get much better understanding of what's going on with the various decisions, understanding how the money is flowing and things like that throughout the various pieces of the system and an acquisition decision process because of new capabilities that we're getting now to track money and do things like that. So that I think it really is a time when we can maybe rethink some of the ways that we measure the performance. I will tell you, back in the 1990s, that was a big item of discussion, and we were saying, well, how do we measure whether any of these things really are effective or not? I mean, is it because the procurement administrative lead time drops to a certain number of days from where it is now? Or is it just because the whole system, the whole process looks prettier when it operates? I mean, we really didn't have a good way of sort of measuring the changes in policy in terms of outcomes. And I think that it was a difficult thing, frankly, for the oversight community as they evaluated individual transactions and tried to relate that to some of the changes to really understand the value, a potential value of some of the things that could happen versus, you know, looking at just how much did we pay for this particular transaction, for the cost for an item or service or whatever the case might be. So I think that made the outcome and that whole process a lot murkier. And I think today we may have better tools for understanding those outcomes and maybe a better basis for going forward.
Well, do you think, I mean, to me, when you mention that, I go immediately to what we constantly hear, I think, from the executive branch these days, is they're measuring, you know, outcomes based on, you know, price alone.
Right.
Frankly, or whether it's low price technically acceptable or strategic sourcing has saved X amount, which, you know, frankly, I don't know how they, you know, they don't really talk about how they got to the numbers or show people how they got to the numbers transparently. But it sounds to me like there, you know, what you experienced is that there's so many different potential data elements going into how do you measure something like that, whether it's procurement lead time or price, which is has to be considered, or, you know, the best value outcome, you know, customer satisfaction with what's delivered, whether it's, you know, healthcare.gov would be, you know, the public in part, right? I mean, there's so many different. To try to figure that out seems to me still would be it's going to be a big challenge.
I think it will be. My only point is I think you have better ways for tracking in more, you know, in sort of contemporaneously, if not real time, sort of tracking a lot of that information and measuring sort of, you know, what effects things like that might have. I think obviously there's a lot of work to be done. But when I see things like, you know, this drive to deploy new business systems, you know, new backbone kinds of things in the agencies, to achieve auditability and other kinds of things, I think the outcome of some of that will be the ability to get much greater visibility into what's actually happening in the process, you know, on a sort of regular near-term basis. And so I don't think we'd had none of that capability back in the 90s to really understand that.
Yep.
And the measures of outcomes were fairly crude. You know, how many people could we get rid of in the bureaucracy, or, you know, that sort of thing. And I think now we have better ways of seeing what the policy implications are in terms of measurable elements. So I'm encouraged by that, at least, that we can have a good conversation around that this time.
Yeah. John, we have to take our next break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we'll continue talking about what the future may portend for acquisition and acquisition reform. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've talked a little bit about, you know, last year's Budget Control Act and, you know, the Defense Authorization Act, and a little bit about, you know, prospects for people looking at, you know, acquisition reform, just a little bit. We've touched on it, but, you know, in that area, you know, I just want to ask you, what's going on there, John? And who's doing what? Who's looking at things? Is it, you know, it sounds like there's a little that the energy is starting to, you know, focus on trying to reduce that transactional cost and, you know, see how we can improve the system.
Yeah, I think, Roger, what I see is sort of an interest in looking at these same issues emerging in a number of different places. On Capitol Hill, the House Armed Services Committee, under Vice Chair Mr. Mac Thornberry, has embarked on a very public effort to try to start a review of this. I think they're in their fairly early stages, doing a lot of outreach and listening. They did one hearing back in October, at the end of October, and basically the question was, after 25 years of acquisition reform, you know, where are we now and where are we going? And had a good discussion around some of those issues. We had another, they had another hearing that was scheduled for last Wednesday, last week, and it did get canceled for weather and other reasons. And I was actually one of the witnesses that was supposed to appear before the committee. And the real issue there was, you know, what are the obstacles that have to be overcome for acquisition reform? And what I chose to discuss and what I was encouraged to discuss by the committee was our experience in the 1990s in terms of how we set up a process for delivering a lot of good feedback from different sources that the Congress could use in formulating the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and how that whole process worked, and our, and it's sort of an assessment of what did work and what didn't work. So I think folks are looking at that now. I don't know if anything analogous to that becomes the process that folks adopt, but what we did have, notwithstanding the hearing getting canceled, we did have some good discussion about that last week. So I think there's a lot of effort there. Mr. Thornberry has indicated that this is a year of oversight, learning, discussion around broader concepts, and if there is legislation to be enacted, it'll probably be as part of next year's defense authorization process. But they, I think the committee has taken a view that they're looking at, you know, removing, sort of cleaning out some superfluous legislation, maybe regulation, policy, trying to figure out what to do about the various layers of oversight in the government and how to measure the value added from all that. And I guess, as I said, they're sort of starting that process on a preliminary basis. There's a similar effort going on the Senate side, actually on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Senator Inhofe has expressed an interest in it, and I think that will be perhaps a little more of a near-term examination, but it's hard to say exactly where that will go. But again, a lot of the conversation around those same issues. And then coming out of the Department of Defense, starting in the fall, they did start reaching out to folks, trying to get a sense of the value-added nature of various things that, that industry had brought forward to them, and they've gotten some feedback from that. We got this public notice or request for public comment went in the Federal Register last Wednesday, asking for some evaluation of statutes in terms of intent and things like that. Relatively short turnaround, 30 days, but so I think there is a sort of a convergence of a lot of different efforts here, and I think it's the hope of the folks in the Department of Defense, as well as on the House and Senate Armed Services Committees, that they have a process in which they, it is a cooperative process, perhaps being nuanced by the various players, but at least a process that will be informed by different efforts and not some, solely people out sort of on their own in different ways trying to do things.
Yes, yes. You mentioned what I, you hit on what I was going to ask about, people doing their own thing or just different efforts all going on at the same time, whether it's potential legislation focusing solely on information technology acquisition reform versus a holistic look across the system. I guess, how does that, as someone who worked up there 18 years, how does that all get sorted out in terms of you've got all these moving parts and different people focusing on different pieces of legislation, and, do you do one thing for IT and while you're looking at the system as a whole? To me, that sort of doesn't make sense, but how do those things get all sorted out? How does that sort of work itself through the process?
Well, let me tell you, and this was the substance of what I talked to the members and wanted to talk to them about at the hearing that was canceled last week. We had a process back in the 90s which started out as something very different than what it actually became based on the events that occurred after we started the process. And what we had done back at that time, as folks will remember, we had a Section 800 of the FY91 Defense Authorization Bill. And what we essentially told the department was go out and find at least 9 really smart people, basically have an effort that's sponsored by the Defense Systems Management College, and look at, focus on the statutes alone, not the regulations and the policies in addition, but just the statutes. Look at the legislative history, what was the genesis or the basis for the genesis of the legislation, look at the congressional intent, do the research, and see if that intent is still valid based on, the world that we had back then or the new things that we're developing. The process itself was not very prescriptive in terms of saying things like, well, figure out a way to make the system buy more commercial products or that sort of thing. It really was pretty open-ended. And those folks went out, and the panel was constituted, the DoD Acquisition Law Advisory Panel, sort of the core group were sort of contracts lawyers, both from the government and the private sector. There was a lot of sort of clustering around the ABA organization and their government contracts folks. And they needed a couple years, and during the couple years that they were working the process, we had Desert Storm, Desert Shield, we had the collapse of the Soviet Union, we had the unification of Germany, and yet, and as well as the rise of the internet and the emergence of that capability, and some of the other electronics and things that were coming out of the commercial sector, and yet they were able to take all that and process it and integrate it into their effort, so that when we got the report, and it was a fairly, you know, 1,800-page report, in January of 93, it was very relevant, and it came at a time when we were really, you know, seriously looking at trying to work that. And even with that product, frankly, it was solely focused on statutory issues. It took the combined work of the staffs of the Senate Armed Services Committee, the Senate Armed Governmental Affairs Committee, and the Senate Small Business Committees, working a good one day a week as a joint group, 9 months just to process that and into something that we could recommend to the members that they consider introducing as a freestanding bill. So you the process is really important, and you have to have. We had a process that fortunately delivered recommendations that were in the form that could actually be used by the Congress.
That's wow. That that's a Herculean effort. That took place when you talk about nine folks and then staffing to do to put together 1,800-page report,
right.
And then to distill that down into legislation. Do you, I mean, if you had a crystal ball, do you see some, do you see a similar process in the future? Do you think there might be a? I mean, you know, what's in store? Do you have any sense at all?
I don't get the sense that people are ready to embark on that road now. But maybe as time goes on and different other things are tried, maybe that becomes a more attractive approach. There's some issues with it. I mean, obviously, you have to start something, have a certain amount of faith that it will go forward, that you'll have the right expertise brought to bear on the issues, and then you have to wait. I mean, if you look at the process, we started the process. We actually reported the bill out of the Senate Armed Services Committee in 1990. It was about 10 days before Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and that sort of changed a lot of things. And then you have to sort of wait and let that process work. And we didn't have the White House signing ceremony until September of 1994. So you have to sort of have some faith and that you know, let the process work and that it can accommodate all the various things that will come up during the interim period. And that
did you, do you think one of the keys back looking back at the time is that you there wasn't a prescriptive like charge for the, you know, for the panel to like go address these issues? It
right.
was more like you guys, whoever we pick, you men and women, whatever.
Yeah, right.
You're experts in this field. You know the field. Take a look at it. Let us know what you think.
Right. I think it was a combination of this sort of non-prescriptive sort of outcome in terms of whatever the recommendations might be with a very, I wouldn't say rigid, but a fairly clear sense of the product, the way it would be structured and the way it would look. Because we had the language in Section 800, which laid out the basic tasking for this panel. But if you go back and look at the Senate Armed Services Committee report, we were very much more specific about what we wanted in terms of this is what we want each of the statutory reviews to look like and the recommendations to look like, and this is what we want you to do in each one. So we sort of gave the panel at that time a lot of freedom to, you know, explore the issues in any way they wanted, but whatever recommendations and whatever pathway from the analysis to the recommendations, we were very explicit in what the expectations were. So I think it was a combination of those two things and the fact that we got a product that was really designed for Congress to use and process for things that they had direct right. jurisdiction over, which was the statutes, that I think was one of the reasons it was so successful.
You know, that what you're telling me is that there was no like prescribed agenda. The
right.
agenda was do good.
Right,
right.
right. We
yeah.
just told everybody to go out. We had one meeting with them at the very beginning and said, scope, do not limit yourself to the laws in Title 10. Anything that bears on procurement, yes, there should be a DOD focus to this, but really it should be a government-wide effort. And I think it was one of the factors in the success that I see in looking back on it was when the report came out, even though we had initiated the process, we basically stepped back and said to the Governmental Affairs Committee, since we were now looking at government-wide recommendations, that we would let them take the lead in terms of running the process and deciding how the issues would be formed. So, and it was a joint thing, bipartisan, with all the various committees working very closely together. And I think that was one of the keys to getting the bill done.
Right. And right now we do, John, we have to take our last break. When we come back, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And we'll talk a little bit. Let's talk, John, let's talk about that Deepak federal notice first when we get back. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
These days, it seems everyone's talking about the new normal, but federal agencies have a chance to define it. How will you shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. We understand what makes America work and how it can work better. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we can help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, or even change the game. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And yeah, John, we went through the 800 panel. You know, the panel was charged with taking a look at the statutes, right? And, you know, providing a report and all that feedback and stuff, or clarify something.
Well, let me make one point, too, about one of the outcomes of the 800 panel process, because, and I wonder if this is also something that we ought to look at in the current process. One of the things that the panel did, and we explicitly told them we would like to see them make recommendations around, was the idea that we needed to align the requirements in statute that apply to the civilian agencies with the requirements that applied under Title 10 to the Department of Defense and the other agencies that are covered by Title 10. And they did that, and I think one of the outcomes of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act was a much closer alignment of the requirements on both sides, which made it, I think, forced, I think, the agencies to sort of broker out some different issues so that they did come up with a set of fairly coherent, consistent requirements, and also allowed industry to essentially have sort of dealing with the government as a single face in terms of the requirements. And I frankly think if you look at the volume of legislation that's gone through Title 10, I mentioned earlier this issue on contractor compensation, where you have one set of people covered under the DOD for DOD contracts and a different set covered under the civilian agency contracts. That needs to be part of this exercise as well, is aligning those two requirement sets.
Yeah, it's like it's like the pendulum swinger, right? Like things got closer together, now they've grown further and further apart over the last 10 years.
Right.
And that's probably partly a product of, you know, the war on terror, 9/11, all the post 9/11 world we lived in, and the ramping up of spending and associated legislation to fix things that came up. And
I also think there was not a real explicit value set on maintaining that alignment. That was just not a conscious goal as folks went through and looked at, you know, different approaches.
You know, it's like regulation duplication. There's contract duplication. You got and the regulations cover the same things, but cover them differently that sort of thing, right? So back to the 800 panel, you know, I guess the point I wanted to make is, you know, the 800 panel took a couple years to review the statutes. And DPAP just put out this notice that you mentioned in our last segment, you know, seeking public comment on the underlying statutes. You know, how is it impacting industry? Mm-hmm. And I think they, if I recall, their estimate was there's about 400 different statutes that are implemented through the DFARs, and I think there's a spreadsheet that has a list of the statutes and the corresponding DFAR segments. And they've given the public 30 days to provide comment. To me, that sort of strikes me as not a realistic approach. You know, when you contrast to what 9 smart people who were, you know, put in a room to take a look at, you know, statutes back under the 800 panel. Thoughts?
I think, and again, I'll try to make a positive comment about that.
I don't want to get you in trouble or anything.
No, you're not getting me in trouble. But I guess to me, I look at that, I don't think, there's no way that you can obviously deal with 400 or 100 or 40 or even a smaller number than that of these statutes in a 30-day time frame and come up with a sound analytic framework around looking at the intent and some of the other things that that notice would ask for. I do think, though, it gives everybody an opportunity to try to figure out, if even if you took one statute in a 30-day period or whatever, whether there is a framework for doing the analysis and coming up with something that could, if nothing else, could be, serve as a model for how you might want to do a broader effort over a longer period of time. I think the questions are the right questions, and again, I think yes. that the idea of looking, let's go back and look at the intent behind the original legislation, whether that intent is still valid, and some of the other issues very closely track, I think, the model that the Section 800 panel tried, and again, takes you away from saying, well, see if the statute means that we, you know, can cut the acquisition cycle time in half or some other specific goal like that. You know, look at it in terms of what the original intent was and based on what we know now. I think that's a very constructive way of looking at that and gives you sort of more of an open-ended way. I think it, you know, the 30-day thing I don't think is really very serious, but I think that it does provide, that at least gets everybody focused, and we'll see what limited information or what kind of a structure of analysis could be produced in that time, and that may be somewhat valuable. I think I would interpret that language as a sort of an opening shot at something that everybody recognizes is, will take longer. The other thing, I think there are two issues with this compared to the 800 process. You mentioned the fact that these folks were down at the Defense Systems Management College, and they had a great staff. They also, because you had a significant government participation in the membership of that panel, you had access to information from the DOD data as whatever the folks from the private sector could bring. And I think having common access to the information and having it sort of be a joint kind of effort, I think, is also one of the things, if you want to have something successful like that, that you need to have. And secondly, I think they tended to look at these things in combination with one another. There was a much more of a holistic look at the interaction between the various statutes, and I think the type of public comment process that the notice came out last week really doesn't afford you the opportunity to do that. They're going to have to figure out some better way.
Right.
To do that.
Yeah. I mean, even the way it's presented and. Yeah, you know,
it's not a matter of individual statutes. Right. You really have to look at the things and how they work in combination. I think that takes a much deeper analysis.
Right, and whether, to your point, the idea whether the intent of the statute, you know, versus what the actual on-the-ground impact of it, do they marry up?
Right.
But it seems to me one of the things that is positive from the perspective of putting that out, or what you hear, the language you hear about it is, can you simplify things?
Right.
Can you make it less complex? And hopefully that means ultimately making it easier to do business with the department.
Right.
Right? I mean, that's some of the things.
Right. No, I think the overall thrust or the aspiration is a good one. I think the process needs a little work.
Do you think that's, you know, I'm going to, you know, segue to another thing. And I guess it's good DPAP is doing that. But also over the last couple of years, you know, the president issued an executive order to talk about retrospective review of regulations.
Right.
And, you know, that's, and I've pointed out that, you know, with regard to the FAR, I don't think it's ever really, you don't see any sense that that's has taken place or a similar effort. Do you think that would be something that would be productive to take a look at? Or even like at GSA, for example, they identified some things we were going to look at, but there's been no real follow-up. But
I think one of the challenges, because this whole system, all of the things that the elements of the acquisition process are so complex in combination that nobody really has the ability to understand everything.
Or the resources, probably.
Yeah, the resources. And as one person said to me back in the 1980s, even if somebody did understand it, nobody would believe them. So I think what you need to do is figure out how do you break up a review and a process that in a way that really recognizes what powers and responsibilities and decision-making capabilities the various stakeholders have on the government side, whether it's in the legislative branch or in the executive branch. How do you figure out a way to sort of, whether it's a regulatory review or whether there's some sort of something that's statutory, and sort of figure out a way for all those things to sort of marry up? I mean, we had again this example that we followed back in the 1990s, where again we started in this 1990 time frame the Section 800 panel. That went off. We had all these world events that occurred that nobody had really thought would happen. And then when the report actually came over in 1993, we had a new administration. Again, you know, some event that nobody really had foreseen one way or the other. Their initial thing that they started within March of that year, that same year, as we were doing on the Hill, doing the review of the recommendations of the 800 panel, They started the National Performance Review with the idea of inside the government of, you know, reducing layers and cutting, you know, red tape and all that sort of thing. Again, a process that nobody had really foreseen would occur. And yet, you know, the two became somewhat synergistic over time as we really entered into some serious conversations with the administration in the fall after we had finished our review, as we were forming the first versions of the drafts of the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act. But again, it was sort of the Congress looking at the statutes, and we really, the regulatory part of that was completely outside of anything we were thinking about. And at the same time, you had this effort going on in terms of the administration and looking at their policies and some of their procedures and that sort of thing, which was an appropriate thing for them to do. And then at some point, seeing how well you could marry that up. I don't think it was a totally happy marriage, in my opinion. I think one of the outcomes that I always thought was not handled nearly as well as it should have been, or in a more considered way, was cutting the acquisition workforce in half, which is one of the things that they did. There was, you know, a lot of issues and problems with that, and I think, in a sense, it undermined the ability to...
We're still trying to recover from that. It's a generation later.
Right, exactly. I think that, you know, was mistaken in the way it was done, and especially over such a short period of time. So, I mean, you can run into problems with that, but I think that's an example, at least, of the various decision makers and stakeholders sort of taking things that are within their purview, and then everybody sort of had some general conceptual ideas out there of what they were trying to reach for, and at some point, you know, that gets married up or one gets weighed against the other. I don't know if you can recreate that process, because it wasn't an intentional process that started.
It's sort of history laid out, and events occurred that married that.
On both sides of that, I think there was enough flexibility, and you had the right level of expertise being involved, that you could sort of pivot or whatever you needed to do as information became available. There was a lot of flexibility in it. So, you know, how you recreate something like that or something maybe that was better than that in the current environment, I think, is something that is worth thinking through.
Right. And on that note, we will be thinking about that, Jonathan. And on that note, I want to thank my guest, Jonathan Etherton of Etherton Associates. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.